can he write a love song?
Hard and lonely, he's too blind to choose her. Open your eyes, she's not one for losers. Love is kind, ease your mind. You got nothing but your soul to find.
Can he sing a love song? Some of his songs are bluesy, some funny, some aching and sad. But of course, that's not all that Chris Smither is about. He takes on mortality and the perennial passing of time. He writes about how we're short-sighted and about learning to see and learning to be or not to be. Chris Smither is a remarkable singer-songwriter who grew up in New Orleans and who in 1966 left his hometown and made his way to New England and the folk scene in Boston, becoming by the 1990s one of the country's most respected acoustic performers. And he has recently celebrated a landmark 50th anniversary in his performing life with the release of this CD, Still on the Levee, a collection of songs, as we're told by his producer, from his past, reimagined, and newly inhabited in the present. Smither is described in these very terms as a profound songwriter, drawing deeply from the blues, American folk music, modern poets, and philosophers. His co-manager tells us Smither's music asks the big questions: why am I here? Is there a purpose to all of this? Or is it just a cascade of random moments? And that brings us right back to the love songs. At the age of 12, Chris Smither just might have had a wisdom beyond his years when he fell head over heels for a T.S. Eliot poem titled The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, verses he learned by heart, a poem which refers to an overwhelming question and seems to circle around the notion of embracing, realizing or not realizing our own individual life, our authentic self. And perhaps that's a key to Chris Smither's longevity as a performer and to the immense respect he's gained among his colleagues. And that is authenticity. His singing voice has been variously referred to as smoky, dusty, weather-beaten, rough-hewn, smoke, and honey-tinged. There's a sincerity and integrity there that rings consistently true, and songs that he sang in his 30s, he can sing in his 70s, and the meaning and emotion has only deepened. So when he sings, "Leave the light on now," these words may be even more poignant at the age of 72.
If I were young again, I'd pay attention to that little known dimension, a taste of endless time. It's just like water, it runs right through our...
If I were young again, I'd pay attention to that little known dimension, the taste of endless time. The races that we've run were not for glory. There's no moral to the story. We run for peace of mind. But the race we're running now is never ending. Since space and time are bending, there's no finish line. I'll live to be 100. I was born in 44, 39 to go, and I ain't keeping score. I've been dead before, but I still fight on. Words from Leave the Light On by Chris Smither, a song that in different versions ends each disc in his most recent CD collection, Still on the Levee. Smither will tell us shortly that the levee where he grew up in New Orleans was his playground, And so when we hear the title of the 50th anniversary set, Still on the Levee, we realize that he is still rooted in that spirit of play and playfulness. In his words, "I've said it often, I think it's true that I write the songs and make the records so that I can go out and play, to create opportunities to play. Playing is the thing, and playing is ephemeral." And so it comes back to the love songs. No matter the subject he's writing about, he is writing because he loves what he does. They're all, in that sense, love songs, and therein lies his power as a person and a performer. The Scranton Public Library will host Chris Smither in concert on Saturday, October 22nd at the Lackawanna College Auditorium. How timely that the Nobel Prize for Literature was just awarded to singer-songwriter Bob Dylan for having created new poetic expressions within the great American song tradition. Because it is the Scranton Public Library hosting Chris Smither, we began our recent conversation with Smither talking about books and poetry and lyrics.
Basically, I'm what's known as a faculty brat. You know, my father was a university professor. And I remember kids coming to our house, other kids, my friends, and they would pass my father's study. Now, we lived in a very typical New Orleans cottage, and what was called a cottage. And the ceilings were 13 feet high, and the walls in my father's study had bookshelves going all the way up to the ceiling, all around, and they were full. And most of the kids that would come to my house had never seen that many books ever in one place, you know, except for my friends who were all, you know, who were also faculty brats, and their father's offices all looked the same, of course. No, it was just that's just the way I grew up. I mean, and books were it's just the way kids are with their devices today. That's what books were to us.
What was Dad's field?
Languages. He was he designed language lab teaching courses and taught Spanish and Portuguese and Latin American literature.
We can't probably say cause and effect, but you had an ear. Did he speak different languages at home?
He didn't. His concentration was more on Spanish than on Portuguese. The Portuguese was a side issue for him. But he was, he was just a language person through and through. And you didn't grow up in my house. You know, you weren't allowed to grow up speaking only one language. That was forbidden. I have a twin sister. When we were 12, you know, the whole family went to Paris for a year and a half, and we were just dropped into a French public school. I mean, it's just, you know, it was my equivalent of seventh grade, and I didn't speak a word of French, and to this day, I still speak French fluently.
So you really were listening you had to listen, survival there, right? Listening.
Oh, right, yeah. You know, it's just books and languages, the whole thing is still just part and parcel of the way I was brought up.
You actually have a book of your own, that lyrics book, right?
Which is... Oh, yeah, I do. That was just a recent thing. Actually, it was all part of sort of a 50-year retrospective. I've been writing songs for 50 years.
Lisa Olsteen, a poet, actually writes the introduction. Does she make comparisons between your lyrics and poetry?
Oh, she thinks I'm a poet. She's told me as much. You know, I'm a great admirer of writers and poets and published people in general. You know, I tend to draw a line between myself and what I do and what I think of as real poets. But she doesn't really do that at all. She says, "Oh, Chris, you know, you're a poet. You know, you rely on rhyme a little more than poets these days do, but, you know, you're a poet." I sort of leave that for other people to say, you know. I try not to make too many claims for myself. I mean, people ask me what I do. I tell them I deal in semi-popular music.
But what about a 12-year-old Chris picking up T.S. Eliot and reading Proof Rock?
I did. I don't know. It's just one of my favorite poems of all time. And to me, I think it was handed to me as something that somebody thought I would find impossibly obscure. And to me, it was just as clear as glass, the whole thing. And I love that poem. I still love it. I can recite whole long parts of it by heart.
Dare I disturb the universe? Grow old, grow old?
I grow old, I grow old. I shall wear the bottoms of my trousers rolled. Shall I part my hair behind? Do I dare to eat a peach? I will wear white flannel trousers and walk along the beach. I have heard the mermaids singing each to each, but I do not think that they will sing to me.
That is so amazing that you've held it so close. And a 12-year-old getting an understanding that I grow old, I grow old?
Well, I'm not sure I understood it as well then as I do now at the age of 72. Yeah, but it spoke to me. I don't know why.
It's gritty, isn't it? I mean, about the image of the gurney with the anesthetized person in the city.
Yes, let us go through. Let's see. How does that, that's in the first verse. Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon the table.
You do know it, and it's not a short one.
And, there's just these verses that are so evocative. You know, when he says, shall I say that I have gone at dusk through narrow streets and watched the smoke that rises from the pipes of lonely men in short sleeves leaning out of windows? I should have been a pair of ragged claws scuttling across the floors of silent seas. Just amazing stuff.
I bet somebody could have set that to music, don't you think?
You could. It would be a sort of free form. I mean, I don't think it would be a standard pop song structure, but no, definitely you could set it to music. Absolutely.
It's a wonderful way for us to begin to talk about your music in a more primary way, in the sense of Still on the Levee, and you mentioned the lyrics book as being part of this 50th retrospective. And you've been writing all along, and you say that this was quite an experience because you hadn't been stopping along the way and saying, I've got this wonderful body of work, and thinking of time from a different perspective. There's a wonderful picture of a beautiful young lady with a violin on the cover of Still
Right.
on the Levee. She's your young daughter. And so we're talking about generations, and you alluded to your dad. So time does pass, and we do mature. So what has this been like in terms of revisiting this body of work?
Well, it was some of the older stuff, it was was difficult to get into. In that I didn't really remember how to do it. I would sit there, that was a little bit of a surprise. I would sit and listen to myself, recordings of myself from, 40 years ago, and I would say, what on earth is he doing? and so some of the arrangements are actually, they're different because I didn't exactly remember how I was playing it, and I couldn't quite figure it out from listening to the recordings, and it was different from the way I would handle the same sort of problem today. So that was interesting, and they changed slightly, but, the thing that I was a little surprised at and most gratified by was to discover that I hadn't painted myself into any corners. There wasn't a lot of stuff that I regretted. it would be so easy to go back and listen as a 70-year-old to something that you'd written as a 20-year-old and say, oh, my God, how could I have thought that at the time? I should have known better. And I didn't really run into any of that. I mean, some of that is because, I was maybe a little careful back then about not being too declarative and absolute in my judgments, but at the same time, it was nice to be able to go back and realize that I could sing the lyrics with some conviction and not have to change anything.
And in order to realize Still on the Levee, you made the pilgrimage back home to New Orleans.
Yeah.
That was important to do it there.
Oh, I think so. I really do. It was very important for me, at least. It may not be important for the normal, for the average listener, but for me it was really important. And partly I think because in a way I had to leave there in order to do what I wanted to do. And that's, you'll find actually that's true of a lot of New Orleans musicians. But maybe it's just true of musicians in general. They have to get away from where everything was developed. So maybe so that they'll have a basis of contrast to work from. But You know, my kind of music is not a big deal in New Orleans, even though it's a huge music city. You know, people used to ask me, you know, well, that's quaint, Chris. What are you going to do for a living? You know, it's a big-time keyboard and horn town, you know, and here I was playing old country blues and trying to write songs on a guitar, and it still isn't a big guitar town, you know. Much as the guitar drives most of pop music in New Orleans, it's a very different sort of scene. But it was important to go back there having, you know, achieved a measure of success elsewhere and go back and just reconnect with the elements and the feel of the town. And, you know, it's a neighborhood city. It's not a big... I used to think it was a big city when I was growing up there. I thought, well, it's a big city. But it's really just a little collection of small neighborhoods and very sort of down-home, a little bit corny. But to this day, I mean, it's amazing. I can walk down the street in New Orleans. I can walk down Canal Street and people will just nod at me as I walk by and say, "Hey, Chris." Like I'd never left. And they're not nodding to say hello to somebody that they think is famous. They're just saying hello to me, you know.
And that says an awful lot, maybe, about the intimacy of the stories that you can tell or you tell and you've been telling us over the years, not necessarily about New Orleans, but that sense of the importance of a community like that. Do you think?
I think so.
You're coming to Scranton, and Scranton and Wilkes-Barre are very close. You've played the Chicory House in Wilkes-Barre. Wilkes-Barre's on the banks of the Susquehanna River, and we call them dikes rather than levees. But levee is a very special term in the world with Katrina, for example. But the levee was your backyard, practically, right?
It was, yes, it was. It was three blocks away, the levee. And now the levee at the foot of State Street and National Avenue is built up. I mean, there's wharves there. You can't really get to the river. But, you know, in my childhood, the wharves stopped at Nashville, at Nashville Avenue. And from there on out, it was just the river. You walked up across the levee and down onto the Batcher, and there was the water. You know, you could stick your toe in it. And it was our playground. It was just acres and acres. And, of course, you know, it stretches for as long as the river stretches, so, you know, you're talking a couple of thousand miles.
But you weren't thinking about it necessarily as a protective device, were you?
No, it was just wild. I mean, it seemed wild. For one thing, it was the only thing in town that wasn't flat. You know, it was a hill. You had to climb up it and over it and down the other side. There are no hills in New Orleans. The only hills are man-made. They're overpasses, things like that. But, you know, to me, it was almost like the countryside.
There's that wonderful story about No Love Today, the fruit and vegetable salesman story. Do you mind telling us how that song came about? That's a lovely story.
They used to have, you know, itinerant sort of street cruising fruit and vegetable men all over New Orleans. They used to be all over. And there was one in particular that came down my street. He would come down twice a week. And he, you know, when I was a boy, a little boy, he had a wagon pulled by a mule. And then he sort of graduated to a pickup truck with big shelves built up on the back of the bed there with all kinds of boxes and crates of produce. And his son would drive the truck, you know, just at a snail's pace down the street, and the old man would walk in front of it. And he didn't so much walk as dance. I mean, he would slide and glide down the street, singing at the top of his lungs, and you could hear him coming all the way down the street, blocks and blocks. You know? Beautiful.
And you remembered his song more than somebody else who was supposed to be an expert.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, my father showed me this. I was visiting him at some point after my mother had died, and he had moved to be in North Carolina close to his brother. My uncle taught at Chapel Hill, and so he was living there. But my father, I went to visit him once, and he said, "I got something to show you." And he showed me a video of a Tulane University history professor and talking about these itinerant salesmen in New Orleans. And he talked about it quite a bit, and then it was in this video. He tried to imitate the song of the fruit and vegetable man, and it was just awful. It was the worst. I said, and I turned to my dad. I said, "That's not what they sounded like." And my dad said, "Wasn't it?" And I said, "No." I said, "Here, and I imitated it." And he said, "Yeah, you're right. That sounds a lot more like it." And then I was thinking, and that was when the idea for the song came to me. I said, "That would make a beautiful chorus, for a song." And of course, my father, who knew nothing about songwriting, he said, "Really? You think so?" And I said, "Yeah, I'll write it." And I was going to be there for several days, and so I started to work on it. And I would sit out on the back porch of his house there in Chapel Hill, working on this song. And he wouldn't come out and listen to me do it. He would pace around inside like an expectant father, at the hospital. And finally, I had it in some sort of reasonable shape, and I played it for him. And he thought it was pretty good, but he was very reluctant to pass judgment on anything that I did. He didn't consider himself competent.
But this is someone who studied language and communication in a fundamental way from different cultures and different ways. But he knew that you had nailed it.
Yeah, he knew. He was very perceptive that way.
Just as you were describing and telling that story and using the word itinerant and dancing and singing and having the fruit and vegetables, is there anything that you might think of that would compare to the life of a singer-songwriter who goes through the country singing and tapping his foot and bringing us these beautiful fruits that would be songs and so forth, but in an itinerant way where you travel from place to place?
Well, that's an interesting comparison. I never really quite thought of it that way. I like to perform, and in order to perform, you have to go. you can't just stand in one place. You have to go where there are people. I mean, I just love doing it. It's the older I get, the more the travel gets to be something of a burden. It's a chore, but I love to play.
And you have lots of friends. You have so much respect among the music community at large, and people have joined you in making your music. I love the story about your getting together and all the singers came together and sang you your songs.
Oh, yeah. That was crazy. And, it's happened twice now. They did it on my 60th birthday. They had a big concert, and all these people doing my songs. And I had nothing to do with that. And then just a couple of years ago, Signature Sounds Records put out a Chris Smither tribute record with, I think, like 15 different artists doing Chris Smither songs. And I had nothing to do with that except that I wrote the songs. But it's one of my favorite records. I sit there and listen to it and go, wow, it's amazing. And the thing that amazes me is that at least half of those songs, those people find things in the songs that I didn't know were there.
I wanted to ask you about two songs, and you're coming to northeastern Pennsylvania, which is the epicenter in the states of anthracite coal, and you do the Miner's Blues. Tell us a little bit about the gist of that song. That's a Frank Hutchinson song.
It's a Frank Hutchinson song, and it doesn't necessarily have a lot to do with mining, I think it mentions trains as much as it mentions, but of course the trains were what carried the coal.
And Scranton has quite a railroading history.
Right, yeah, of course. I was actually talked into learning that song and doing that song by a woman who was writing a book on Frank Hutchinson and on the music like that in general. And she realized at one point that I had quoted or used parts of a Frank Hutchinson song in a version that I do of Blind Willie McTell's Statesboro Blues, sort of a medley kind of thing. And so she asked me if I would record that song, Miner's Blues, for her own purposes, and I liked it so much that I wound up doing it on a record.
Statesboro Blues I came across in a short story by Johanna Sinisalo, an award-winning Finnish writer.
Yeah.
Yeah, she talks about you in the short story.
I didn't know nothing about this. I'm amazed.
Here's the quote. He sat back on my old sofa, knocking yesterday's newspaper onto the floor, and took a big drink. Chris Smither? His eyes lit up for a moment. Yeah, he did that cool arrangement of Statesboro Blues. How'd that go again? He put his mug down, dot, dot, dot. That's in a short story titled Baby Doll by Johanna Sinisalo, and it's in the year's best science fiction 13 collection.
I gotta check that out.
Just to tie the knot, leave the light on, ending both CDs in the collection with that, and of course it's appropriate. Was it a hands-down, yes, this is how we're going to end these CDs?
That was my producer's preference, and I generally tend to take his advice. But I agreed with it, you know, mainly because I often finish sets with that song. And so it was appropriate to do that, as you mentioned. But also, they're two entirely different versions of the song, and we couldn't decide which one to use, and so we just sort of went with both.
In those days we were single, we lived them one by one. Now we hardly see them, they don't walk, they run. But I got plenty left, I've set my sight on. Don't wait up, leave the light on, I'll be home soon.
Singer-songwriter Chris Smither speaking with us in anticipation of his return visit to northeastern Pennsylvania, hosted by the Scranton Public Library on Saturday, October 22nd at 7 in the evening at Lackawanna College Auditorium, 501 Vine Street in Scranton. The proceeds will benefit the Scranton Public Library. For more information on the web, www.albright.org. www.albright.org. Chris Smither speaking with us in anticipation of his concert Saturday, October 22nd at 7 in the evening at Lackawanna College in the auditorium there, 501 Vine Street in Scranton. For more information on the web, albright.org, albright.org. The concert is being presented by the Scranton Public Library.
That drummer in my head needs inspiration. There's a lack of syncopation, and it holds me to a lie. It's just so hard to leave these cages that we think in. By stages we just sink into a slow decline. For years we lived in waltz time, we danced it three by three. Now it's hard to dance, but if you stick with me, we got what we need to spend the night on. Don't wait up, leave the light on, I'll be home soon. These races that we've run were not for glory. No moral to the story, we run for peace of mind. But the race we're running now is never ending. Space and time are bending, and there's no finish line. I will live to be 100, I was born in 44. 32 to go, but I ain't keeping score. I've been left for dead before, but I still fight on. Don't wait up, leave the light on, I'll be home soon. 'Cause I've been left for dead before, but I still fight on. Don't wait up, leave the light on, I'll be